Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Dalitz.
Hello and welcome back to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. My name is Matthew Dalitz from the Science of Psychotherapy and I'm here with Richard Hill. Howdy, Richard.
Hi, Matt. How are you? How is everybody? Hope we're all well and thriving in the best way we can.
Doing well. Now, Richard, today we are going to a cafe with you to talk to Teddy Velez, one of our resident experts.
Yeah, it was wonderful. He was out here for the IAAN conference, which everybody's heard from us before. And so I sort of grabbed him. He kind of grabbed me too. He said, let's meet and we'll have a bit of a chat. And then while we were chatting, I thought, this is pretty good, Teddy. Let's record this and we'll pop it up. And he sort of said, oh all right. So suddenly had performance anxiety. And away we went. And I think we've managed to make the sound pretty good. It was a bit of a noisy cafe.
All right.
But there's some really fascinating things because he does this wonderful work talking about orchid children, orchids and dandelions.
Yep.
And we've got some wonderful articles, and I don't know whether his article's coming up after this podcast or before, but catch it because we really get a deep insight to the wonderful work and thorough research and very, very well thought out research that Teddy has done.
Yeah, brilliant. So if you're not familiar with Teddy, we'll put some links in the show notes to some of his articles and his profile page on the Science of Psychotherapy. So let's go to the cafe.
So your work now, so where are you based? You're based in?
In San Jose, California. So that's like Silicon Valley.
Fantastic.
Where all Apple and Facebook and
yes.
all those Netflix is down the street.
No human beings, all just robots everywhere working. But that's cool. So what, is everyone a little crazy there? I don't know. I'm just wondering, you know, dealing with all that,
well,
that pragmatic sort of...
So this is the way that I understand it or have conceptualized it. You know this concept of the orchid child, right?
Yes.
The sensitive
You've been talking
child.
About that one. Yeah.
I've learned that, because these people, they are highly driven by dopaminergic activity. So they're the ones that seek out. They're the ones that go and go into new environments. They're very driven. And so most of my clients, I've realized, not only the kids, but the adults, have this high dopaminergic predisposition that makes them very sensitive and also very gifted and talented. It just so happens that the adults have learned to better manage their anxieties through whatever medication they're using, workaholism.
Yeah.
Some of them are in their head. I mean, that's very high dopamine in the in the cortex.
Yeah.
And they also grew up, you know, 30, 40 years ago when things were not as whacked. It was more of a village.
Yeah.
So now
yeah.
their offspring,
yeah.
which genetically they're the same, they don't have the support structure, so they just blow up and they just have this huge tantrum. So it's very common for me to start talking to a mother about this research, and she's like, oh my God, I know you're, there's no doubt that you are describing my 7-year-old son, but you're also describing my husband. It just doesn't fail. Now, the woman usually, they also have it, but they express it. Women are more sophisticated in the way that they express the dysregulation. They're more composed. They're, you know, kind of boys just kind of fall apart. And the way that they manage the dysregulation is more acceptable.
I think broadly, I'm a great one for saying that let's not get too carried away with gender difference.
Sure,
but
sure,
I think
sure.
we have very, very large and very, very strong and dominating cultural gender difference that really amplifies the biological and genetic difference. And I think your work on dopamine is a really good focus. And hopefully you noticed my article. No, I did an article which clarified the four different aspects of dopaminergic process in the brain, which was just useful.
The different, what do you call those?
Well, you're the different pathways. Yeah. So you've got the limbic one, you've got the basal ganglia one, you've got the frontal cortex and the tuberoendofundibular one. But dopamine is fascinating, and I love the stuff you wrote about it. It's fascinating because it's got so many different. It can do it too much. It does this too little. It does that. And getting it just right all over the place. It's one of the more difficult ones.
Because, yeah, in different places, you need different balances. Your seven-year-old screams at you. It's possible that it reminds you of how your husband, maybe he doesn't scream at you, but maybe he makes you feel in the same way.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that, you know, like, so it's almost to help them understand what's really the trigger. It's not the kid.
Yeah.
It's the meaning.
Yeah, and dopamine also just pushes that need and demand, the need and demand things. And in a higher testosterone person, be that male, mostly is, but sometimes female, then aggression is an absolutely natural response to a dissatisfaction at not achieving your demand.
Yeah. The way that I described what you just said is that when we feel uneasiness, we need to control to downregulate our anxiety. And so when you have a kid that's controlling, it's communicating that something is not right. They're not doing it just because you're not that important.
And here's
it's not about you.
And there's this wonderful thing of Ernie Rossi and I pushing my book as well. But sensitive observation, and all these little clues, they're not so much the problems, they're the messages. And I was saying this when I was in acting school, the problem is a message. And now, 20 years later, I'm going, oh, that actually was, well, that's true, you know, from a neurobiological basis. So of course, you know, the article, hopefully we'll broadcast this, but, you know, go into the neuropsychotherapist, which of course in a very short space of time, and probably by the time we put this one on, will be now the science of psychotherapy. Let's just let loose of the constraints, mm-hmm. let loose of the barriers. We don't have to talk about neuroscience, but we can.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to talk about immunology and dopamine, but we can.
Yeah.
We don't have to. And actually what we can do is we can talk about all of them. We can talk about the behavior, and then the dopamine, and then the numerology, and then what's their diet, and how are they sleeping? And then, you know, what's their history?
I like it, yeah.
And what are their genetics?
Yeah. I like it, yeah.
This is where we're going.
It's perfect timing, because I've been working on this stuff for a couple of years, kind of weaving. I really wanted it to be a protocol.
Yeah.
Alex, there's this woman that goes to the...
Cheta Harris?
Yeah, her. But when Alex published her book, I kind of sent her some emails, and she's like, just kind of like, how do you create what you did? It's like, you have to just really focus and just create a product, a protocol. And I never forgot that email that she sent me back. So that's what I've been doing. You know, I didn't want it to just be an application. I still have way more to go. I mean, I want to do a book. Yeah. I think initially they need kind of the little training wheels.
Absolutely.
And some of them will record me initially, like, how do you say that narrative, you know? And my goal is for eventually for them to, they'll come back and they'll tell me, you know, how they said it to their kid. Usually I'll get tears in my eyes because it's almost like I'm seeing my work in them, because they need to make it theirs. I don't want them to say it the way I say it.
Well, it's the client, that's what the client responsive is that we talk about.
Yes, because that's what the kid is going to respond to, the way they say it.
Yeah.
Not the way Teddy says it.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about, I had a conversation yesterday at the conference with this lady. I was telling Mary Bowles, sitting right next to me, that...
As we know Mary well. Yeah,
yes. That I haven't found... I mean, I've done a lot of things in the U.S. about related to psychotherapy. I've never found this energy that I keep coming to Australia to seek. And was trying to figure out what is it, because you know, like I find that and this is, you know, this doesn't apply to everybody, but I've gotten a sense of a lot of entrepreneurship, a lot of thinking out of the box. And this lady, what she added to that is like, you know, Australians are all about the relationship, they're very relationship oriented, whereas Americans will come with their companies, and it's almost like we are the best. Whereas Australians are all, and I'm just kind of paraphrasing what she said, it's all about collaborating. No, we're not the best. You're maybe an expert on this area, but there's room for every or other people.
Yeah, we kind of need each other a bit more.
Yeah, that. And you know, maybe it has to do with, you know, Australia being so isolated.
That too.
You know, so, for the US to be such a, you know, thriving and rich place, for what you're doing to not have such a bigger scale over there. I don't know of it. So yeah, I'm constantly seeking, and
dopamine.
Yeah.
No, but it is. And of course, Jacques Panksepp's
principles. It works both ways, right? So it's a devil that you have to be friends with, kind of thing. You know?
Well, this is what Panksepp said. Seeking is not a good thing or a bad thing. It's a drive. And so my work is, you know, the curiosity tempers seeking towards a positive bent.
Yes. So. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I had a teacher in high school that got close to me and said, Teddy, I want to mentor you because I see this like immense energy and charisma. It can be used for good, but it can be used for evil. And I want to help you. You know, like, yeah. But yeah,
what a great
dopamine.
Teacher that
yeah. comes from. Oh, yeah. Yeah, when I didn't get like 100%, I changed in university, but when I was in college and high school, I needed, like, and I was furious. And he's like, I'm scared. You know, like, no, you can't. Let's wiggle you a little bit. Let's stretch you a little bit, you know? And I owe a lot of that to him. Yeah,
and that,
for sure.
And that permeates into your work, as far as
I
can see.
But I could have gone very cerebral, yeah. I had influences like that really, like, stretched me and kind of added the human component, and then I ended up studying a lot of psychology, even though I major as an, you know, engineering.
Yeah.
So I would raise my hand, you know, in this power plant design class that I took. I would raise my hand, that professor was so mad at me. He's like, well, so we can design all these engines and all these turbines, but what if the person is having a bad day at home and forgets to, you know, do the human aspect, and then the entire thing, how do we design for that? Like, who takes care of that? Oh, that man was so upset.
Oh
my God. It's almost like that was for the cleaners, you know? But it's important, because your machine is not going to work if you don't take into account the human element. People, therapists are getting their training in, you know, brain-based training. But that training sits on top of who the person is.
Yeah.
And so who that person is at the core, it's almost like if you remodel your home, the foundation, you put the remodeling on top of the foundation, and if you have a cracked foundation, it doesn't matter how beautiful the remodel is, it's not gonna do its thing. So how it's applied depends on the perspective of the person. We could have gone to the same class, but if I'm all about the baby needs the mother, and the mother needs to provide this goodness of fit, and the person right next to me is about consequences, the baby needs to spank into place, then we're gonna utilize, it's the same model of avoidance and approach pattern, right? And networks, but how you take it is gonna be based on who you are.
Yeah.
And that, there's not an easy thing, you know, that's just the way it is, right? Because
I think it's very true. That it reminds
that's
me,
the essence.
It was interesting in the Brain and Mind Sciences degree, there was a young lass in there who was brilliant. And even though the way she applied it is exactly the same, it was applied on her. So she framed her orientation was her brilliance. of knowledge. And she would tick all the boxes, so we would get case studies, and we'd go off in groups to do case studies. And she hated working with me, because she would tick all the boxes and say, right, it's so-and-so, a good DSM thing, or a pathology base, where we think of a pathology base. And, you know, quite often I agreed with her, of course, but there were also a number of times where I'd just sit there and go, I don't know. And she'd say, oh, Richard, why? You know, and I'd say, it doesn't feel right. Because I was coming from this application orientation, from the actor, from the, you know, the sensitive observer.
Yes, yes.
And the thing that used to peeve her more often than not was that I was usually right. That she had gone for the obvious and had missed the nuance.
It's that you know, that left brain where you're picking right here, you know, like eating the food, you know, like in Ian's book.
You eat the food, but you miss the flavor.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that's really, and you know, it's I've had this has happened a lot. You know, when I work with female clients, sometimes they've worked with females for many years.
Yeah.
And if there's some sort of trauma, my approach is to embrace the trauma, not avoid it.
Yeah.
Make friends with it, right? Otherwise, a lot of therapies focus on coping skills, and what that does is that it almost strengthens the defense. That's the way that I interpret it. And you think that it's gone, but when you least expect it, when you need it the most for you to have your stuff together, the trauma comes over and takes. It's almost like the trauma happened 20 years ago, but. So you're not really healed. You've just been coping.
Yeah.
And when I inherit this client and I talk to the old therapist at the request of the client, what the therapist says is that they feel uncomfortable doing just that, which is to help the client embrace. Instead, they just kind of like provide support.
Yeah.
And that can be, I understand the role of support, but support can result in almost me as a therapist, I'm going to help you as my client, oh poor thing of that horrible thing, and it's almost like we make the monster even bigger.
Yeah.
The fear of the therapist that by helping the client embrace their integrating, that's so, you know, like integrating, because that trauma is part of you.
And it's true.
You have no choice. It becomes your worst enemy if you isolate it from yourself.
Yeah.
But if the therapist feels that you are somehow traumatizing the client by doing that, because you have your own trauma, you know, you see,
And re-traumatization and enactments, and there's lots of things. There's a lot of skill and perhaps that's one of the comments, that really therapists, the most important skill that they need is this ability to be able to deal with difficult subjects in such a way that it doesn't hurt the client and doesn't hurt them. But those techniques are under-trained, and that's really a humanistic thing. I don't know, I think I learned more about that in acting school than I did in any of my training with
people don't want to be bad, they don't want to be fired, and so I think you default to throttle less.
Yeah.
And I'm just upfront, and I just tell them what my approach is, and I just tell them, you know, you might not, compared to other therapists, I don't know, you might not like this, but this is what I believe will help you. The difference between coping on a daily basis and really embracing that this is part of you. I read Rollo May. I was reading one of his books, and he was talking about a client that was the illegitimate daughter of a prostitute. And this woman would have nightmares every day. And eventually, she arrived one day and announced, I don't have nightmares anymore. And Rollo May goes, well, why? What happened? She's like, I am the illegitimate daughter of a prostitute. that's who I am.
Yeah.
That's not only who I am. I'm many more things, but I am that as well. So she was able to integrate. She wasn't fighting it
that's
anymore.
Right. And her disturbance was the fact that she was trying to
she
not be
fighting,
part of herself.
Yes.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
In our culture, I mean, there's a lot of movements that go against that.
The fragility, I think, just running around full circle my head to the orchid child. The possibility and fragility of the orchid child is what is captured so beautifully in your article. It's not about what's in the individual, it's their juxtaposition with their outside world and their inside world. And the therapist can't sit there and be afraid of any of those things.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I understand when people are. I don't.
Yeah, and you know, I sometimes think about this because in essence, I mean, just this concept of calling a boy a sensitive orchid to their father, you know, that in our culture is, I mean, some fathers like growl at me. Like they just do not like that. They just get so angry. And but you know what? I can't do it any other way because they need to know that this is who their kid is. I'm coming up with a different name. I'm gonna call them elastic children.
Yeah.
Brain plasticity. So that get rid, but this is a problem for men, a big problem. They cross their legs, they are, you know, their posture, you know, like, that is a challenge. Is what the meaning, the cultural meaning. And I'm trying to tell you that your kid can be the next Steve Jobs. I'm all about how do we move forward. That yes, this happened, and we'll embrace. We'll
acknowledge it,
process it. But this therapy, that is just the beginning of this therapy. The 90% of it is how do you integrate that into your life.
Yeah.
And some people do not want to do that 90%. They only want to do the 10%.
Yeah. And how do we get to then the growing edge? Yes, without integration, there's
easier.
No
well, but here's the thing. In order to do the 90%, you have to suffer. There has to be some pain. When you're in the 10%, you're in anger. So
yeah.
you're in a controlling state.
So it's a protective mechanism.
Yes,
yeah.
But you will stay protected forever.
Yeah, yeah.
That. So this is where the brain comes into place.
It's a lot more complex. Than just our discussion. But there's a lot to do. There's a lot to do. There's a lot to understand. And who knows which little bit of knowledge from which discipline is going to be the stuff that triggers you or whoever it is, someone as an individual, to get the best way for them to be able to manifest these clarities and effective therapeutic processes. It's really interesting.
You know, another something that I just came up for me as I was hearing you say that is that I think it's okay for therapists to create, to figure out what population and in which way they're best at.
Define what they're best at and do that.
Yeah, because I think that it might be impossible to expect a clinician to be able to treat.
Yeah, for someone to be able to do
everything.
Anyone. Yeah.
Everyone and everything, right? Yeah, yeah.
And maybe we don't need to. I'm just thinking of an orchestra. I'm sure that there are the lead violinist is probably quite good at playing the piano, but he says, "No, I think I'll play violin."
Mm-hmm.
You know,
least for now, right? Maybe they'll switch over in 10 years or whatever. Yeah.
And the string instruments and the winds, they can all sort of thing, but they go, "This is where I'm best for now."
Mm-hmm.
That's a really beautiful thought to leave people with. You know, what is the best that you can bring in order to create beneficial change now?
Yeah.
And why not do that?
And
yeah.
To be very clear, you know,
yeah.
As to what that is. I mean, yeah, it's a boundary. It's a healthy boundary. Yeah.
And if it changes, if you grow and it changes or expands later. I mean, I thought it was acting. Now it's neuroscience. Who would have thought? Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna turn this off.
Sure.
even though there's a mile of stuff there that we probably won't.
Okay, that was fantastic, Richard. It was so nice to be able to drop in and eavesdrop on your conversation. And isn't this where we learn so much? Just getting together over a cuppa.
It really is. I had the good fortune when John Arden was also out for the IAAN conference, and we met and we were walking along, and John just turned around and said, isn't this amazing that, like, for a job, we just meet all around the world and talk about life.
Yes.
And talk about, with passion, about what's going on inside our heads and what's going on inside our body. In fact, I jokingly said to him, the people in the on the table sitting next to us should pay us $200 for the free conference they got. But yeah, right. And he's right. And I really enjoyed this conversation with Teddy. So,
okay.
And I'm glad we had a listen to it.
Beautiful. So if you want to go a little bit deeper, I will put links in the show notes of some of Teddy's articles. He's got a rather large article coming up in the Science of Psychotherapy soon, so look out for that one. Well, thank you, Richard. Thanks for taking your recorder along to the cafe.
My pleasure.
And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast, and we will catch you next week for another episode. Looking forward to that. Thanks, Richard.
See you next time.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.